Space, time, and matter. The mysterious forces of nature. What is gravity? All the symbols representing all the elements around us. Bright minds known as theoretical physicists. Everything falls to Earth with the same acceleration.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Howard Burton. I'm Executive Director of Perimeter Institute, and it's truly a pleasure to see all of you back again for yet another season of our monthly public lectures. It's wonderful to see such an incredibly strong turnout on this November evening. Not sure exactly how many of you there are, but give us a week or two and we'll give you an exact count. So it's a wonderful privilege and treat to be able to introduce the speaker for this evening's lecture to kick off this year's series. Professor James Robert Brown is professor of philosophy at University of Toronto. He received his PhD in philosophy of science from the University of Western Ontario and has consistently demonstrated a very vigorous and lively production output in a variety of fields, philosophy of physics, philosophy of mathematics, sociology of science, and has written repeated books, or numerous books, has repeatedly demonstrated his ability
to write every time.
Yes, absolutely. On a wide variety of topics, one of which we will give away later on this evening. And to a lucky winner. This is all part of the new, exciting razzle-dazzle showmanship of Perimeter Institute's lecture series. And tonight, Professor Brown will be speaking about proofs and pictures, the role of visualization in the mathematical and scientific world. So, ladies and gentlemen, Professor Brown.
It seems particularly appropriate to be here one day after the U.S. election. Often things don't turn out the way we want. It was Bertrand Russell, I think, who remarked that when the world disappoints, it's nice to escape into Plato's realm where everything is as it should be. I'm going to talk about proofs and pictures. And just to set the stage, let me talk about what's a very common attitude among working mathematicians and logicians, and, well, it's a widespread feeling, I'm sure. And that is that pictures and diagrams inside math are not bad as psychological aids, but they are not evidence. For evidence, you need proofs. There's lots of statements of this. One of the more famous comes from Lagrange, one of the truly great mathematicians of all time. And look what he says in the preface of his very famous book, published a little more than 200 years ago. No figures will be found in this work. The methods that I set forth require neither constructions nor geometrical or mechanical arguments, but only algebraic operations subject to a regular and uniform procedure. As I say, it's a very common attitude. Most working mathematicians, and now computer scientists too, I suspect, would hold such a view. Probably most philosophers of mathematics, most logicians, and so on. And here's what most people will say. They'll say, oh, well, pictures and diagrams are terrific in some respects. For instance, they're useful psychological aids. They provide insight. They're terrific for teaching. They're heuristically suggestive, so you can draw yourself a picture and it might actually suggest a proof for you. And they're even a lot of fun. Okay, I mean, you can show them to one another and entertain your friends, good party tricks and stuff like that. But pictures are not evidence. Inside mathematics, there's only one way to have evidence for a theorem, and that's a proof, a traditional proof. It's a verbal, symbolic argument, and a picture is just, you know, as I say, it's helpful, but it's not the real McCoy. You need a proof for real evidence for a theorem. And in fact, it could be even worse. Pictures actually are dangerous. They can often mislead us. So what I want to do is bludgeon you with examples. There can never be an argument, you know, a proof that pictures work. What I do is just give you lots of examples, and you say, yeah, gosh, I think that works, actually. And you become sort of overwhelmed with the examples, I hope, and you become persuaded that maybe pictures aren't so bad. They're also fun. Okay, so here's a theorem, simple theorem from number theory. 1 plus 2 plus 3 plus 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 up to the number n. And here's a little way of calculating it very easily rather than adding it all up. You square n and divide by 2, and you divide n by 2. And that'll give you the answer. Now, there's a normal way of proving this. It's called mathematical induction. And what you do is you show that the theorem holds from the number 1, and then you show that if it holds for any arbitrary number, it would have to hold for the next number. And you put those two facts together, and that gives you the proof that it holds for every single number. But I want to give you a picture proof, and I'll let you mull it over for a minute or two. Well, not a minute or two. 15 seconds. That's all you've got. And see if you can figure out how this little picture works as a proof of that theorem. You probably don't need the hint, but I can tell you. 1 plus 2 plus 3, okay? Look at it just for a minute, 15 seconds, and see if you can figure out how it works. I'll explain it in a minute in case you can't. Well, it works like this. The little squares, of course, correspond to individual numbers. Now look over on the right-hand side, n squared. Here's n, okay, we've summed up to n. And now n squared would be this square over here, right? And we've cut it in half with that diagonal. So all of this white area here, the squares in white, are the half of n squared. Now look at all the bits we cut off with the diagonal. We don't want to get rid of those, so we add them back in. And here we're adding up the half of the n. We've actually, how many numbers have we got? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. So the right answer is 5 squared, cut in half, and 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, cut in half. And that'll give you the right answer as the sum of the first 5 numbers. Okay? So the picture demonstrates it. But look, when you see it and when you get it, and when you see the picture and you see how it works, one thing that you can somehow or other see is that it works for every single number. So if you looked at the picture and said, okay, I'm convinced. 1 plus 2 plus 3 plus 4 plus 5 equals, and then fill in, you know, for 5. Say, yeah, but does it work for 27? Okay? Now, if somebody asked that, you'd say, well, you just don't understand. You haven't got it. And if you do get it, you see that it works for every single number, right? I think this little proof here is just as powerful as the standard so-called proof by mathematical induction. Okay? It seems to me just as strong, just as persuasive. Okay. Here's another example, also from number theory. This is, here we're just adding up odd numbers, okay? 1 plus 3 plus 5, blah, 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 and so on. So in this case, we're adding up to the number, let's see, 1 plus 3 plus 5 plus 7 plus 9 plus 11. Okay, so we're up there, but it's actually just 2 times 6 minus 1 is 11, okay? So what's the answer? It's 6 squared. So if you want to add up those numbers, the answer is very easy to calculate. It's just 6 squared. And when you look at the diagram, you can see all generality in the diagram. It's true. This is a special case. It's a special case where n equals 6. But you can see that it works for any single number at all. Okay? Okay, those are a couple of nice examples from number theory. It's more common to think of pictures in connection with geometrical objects. But here's one from infinite series. Okay? Now, if you had an infinite series and you were you didn't know what the answer is, okay? You're not really sure what the answer is. The sum of 1 over 2 to the n. So that gives you the numbers 1/2 plus a quarter plus an eighth plus a sixteenth and so on. All infinitely many summed over that whole series. The answer to that is 1. That's the sum of that series. Now, there's a normal way of proving that. You use what are called epsilon-delta methods, and you show that, you know, well, it's a long, complicated argument. It takes a lot of skill it's an important skill to acquire if you're going to be a serious working mathematician. But there are proofs of that series that are actually quite simple, quite straightforward. And here it is, okay? Now, look at how this proof works. This is a unit square, all right? It equals 1. And here's half of it, here's a quarter of it, here's an eighth of it, a sixteenth of it, and so on and so on and so on and so on. And you can work your way right through, and you see that the series exhausts the square. And so that the sum of the series is equal to 1. And that's a little picture proof of it. Here's a much more complicated one. That last one was actually easy. This is a much more challenging one. Okay? And it's the sum of another infinite series, and it's 1 over 4 to the n. So it'll be 1 over 4, and the second term will be 1 over 4 squared, all right, which is 1 over 16. The third term is 1 over 4 to the third, which is 1 over 64. Okay, so that's how it's working. A quarter plus a sixteenth plus a 64th, and so on. What does it equal? The answer is 1/3. And this proof here, this picture proof is actually ingenious. The first one was kind of straightforward. Anyone could think of that, I suppose. But this one is really very clever. So look how it goes. So this is the first term in the series is 1/4. And here it is. 1/2 times 1/2 is 1/4. It's a quarter. It's a quarter of the whole square. Again, a unit square. What's the second term? It's 1/16. That is 1/4 times 1/4. And that gives you this. This is 1/16 of the whole square. All right? And on it goes. The terms go like that. Okay? Filling up here. Now, how do you get the answer, though? Oh, this is especially clever. Here, this part is 1/3 of this. This is 1/3 of that. This is 1/3 of that, and so on and so on and so on. So the shaded areas sum up to 1/3 of the whole thing. And that's the proof of the sum of the series. Okay? The epsilon-delta proof of that is several lines long, and it's messy and complicated. And unless you're really skilled at it, and I'm not, it took a lot of trial and error for me, anyway, to get there. Okay. All right, now, I think it's probably, I know there are some professional mathematicians in the audience, so let me give them one that they may not have seen before. This is a little more challenging to see how this one works. This is a lovely example from the British mathematician Littlewood, who flourished in the first half of the 20th century. Okay? He's one of the few people who actually likes picture proofs. One of the best pictorial arguments, I'm quoting Littlewood now, one of the best pictorial arguments is a proof of the fixed point theorem in one dimension. Let f of x be continuous and increasing in the interval between 0 and 1. Okay? Where the where the values satisfy between 0 and 1, okay? The values of the function. And then what we do is reiterate the function. So f2 is f of x, and so on, all right? Then, here comes the statement of the theorem. Then, under iteration of the function f, every point is either a fixed point or else converges to a fixed point. And then, now that's not intuitive at all. I mean, if you didn't have a diagram to go along with this, you'd certainly wonder whether that's true. You'd have a hard job of proving it and so on. But here's what Littlewood says. For the professional, the only proof needed is this figure. And then if you study the figure, picture proofs don't have to be instantaneous. It may take a little bit of work. If you study the figure, then you see how it works. Okay, so here's the value of x. Here's f of x. Okay, and so we'll move over here to the value x. Okay, which is now plugged into the second iteration of the function, and there's the value f of x, and so on. And you see how it's going to converge. This is going to converge up to here, where the final value is just, in fact, x. So that'll be your fixed point. Or you could, of course, just start there, and then you'd have it automatically. But after the iteration, you see that it's going to converge there. That won't be obvious to you unless you're a mathematician. But I wanted to have a spectrum of examples, and that's a particularly nice one. Okay. Now, you've seen a few examples, and just imagine I've shown you 150, and they're all terrific. You say, wow, I believe it now. I'm going to give up my old ideology, and I'm going to go for picture proofs every time. Well, the trouble is, there's good reason for why some people tell you never trust a picture. Okay? Always look for one of those good old-fashioned verbal symbolic proofs. And the reason is pictures can often mislead us very, very badly. Here's an example, and I'll try to make it a picturesque presentation of the example. Okay, here's a representation of a series, 1 over n squared, all right? So this is 1, this has area 1, this has area a quarter, a ninth, and so on, okay? Now, I want you to imagine yourself with a bucket of paint. You've got a liter of paint, and you've got a paintbrush. And you can come up here, and you can slap paint on this series, okay? So you go paint, 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 and you get a little fine brush, and you're painting here. And, of course, you have to keep painting infinitely far over there, all right? But the idea is that... Here's a fact about it. Your 1 liter can of paint will cover the shaded area. You can paint it all with 1 liter, okay? All right, take that as a fact. Now I show you this second series here. This is 1 over n. All right, so this is 1/2, 1/3, 1/4, and so on. If you look at the two diagrams, they look sort of similar. You know, it's getting smaller and smaller. You imagine it trailing off to 0. It's true that the bottom one is a little bit bigger term by term than the top one, but it's pretty close. So if I said to you, all right, it took 1 liter for the top, how much paint do you need for the bottom? Now, those of you who've done a little bit of math, you know the answer to this, right? How many actually know the answer? Okay, well, a lot of you are going to be shocked. It actually takes an infinite amount of paint to cover this area. Okay? 1 liter will do this one. Infinite, there's not enough paint in the universe to paint the bottom one. In a sense, that's a deeply misleading picture because it looks like, woo, twice as much, you know, I'll be generous, twice as much, that should do it. But the picture actually misleads us very, very badly. Okay. Now, There's something the moral that a lot of people, of course, take away from that is, well, you know, you should just never trust pictures. Pictures are dangerous things. Stay clear of them. Always look for verbal symbolic arguments. And so we need to actually remind ourselves about some of the problems of verbal symbolic arguments, the kind of thing that you're normally, if you're a mathematician, the kind of thing that you normally construct, the kind of thing that your teachers tell you you must do, never submit a diagram as a proof on an exam, and so on. Okay? But here's what's wrong with ordinary proofs. Ordinary proofs are seldom fleshed out in full detail. They are sketches. So there's a lot of room for mistakes to be made. Second, the thing that we really understand in a derivation is what logicians call first-order logic. But actual working mathematics uses higher-order logic all over the place. And higher-order logic is not as well understood as so-called first-order logic. It's perhaps a little dicey. We're at least not sure of it. Also, when you're doing a proof, you have to start with first principles, such as axioms. But the trouble is with axioms that they are themselves unproven. So you always have to start with, you know, some sort of assumption that's coming out of nowhere. Where are those axioms coming from? In a huge amount of mathematics, both historically and even today, what's called naive set theory is still used. Naive set theory is actually inconsistent, but people happily use it. They just steer away from the obvious places. But naive set theory leads to a thing called Russell's paradox. Many of you will have heard of that. And it's really just a logically inconsistent theory. Nevertheless, people use it. So it's not clear whether they might be inadvertently dragging in nasty consequences that they don't know about. Very often in mathematics, we use computers to prove things. It's becoming increasingly popular because of their tremendous power. But there are two problems with computers. One is the software itself. Nobody can prove that a piece of software is bug-free or problem-free. Any of you who've bought the latest commercial software know full well that there can be, you know, nasty bugs in it. And also there are problems with hardware, even. The most wonderful reliable parts in the world are still flawed from time to time. Supercomputers make mistakes, computational mistakes, on average about once every 1,000 hours. Why? No one's quite sure. It's probably a cosmic ray passing through the chip. There's no way of controlling this at all. It's really interesting how sometimes computer proofs where many, many hours of computation have been required. It's interesting how people handle this very problem. There was a remarkable result proved about 10 years ago by a fellow at Concordia in Montreal, and he required about 5 or 6,000 hours of Cray supercomputer time. And so he knows that there's this problem about mistakes cropping up on average of about once every 1,000 hours, so he's pretty sure there's mistakes in the proof. So what does he do about this? Well, what it was a proof of I won't even tell you what what the example is. I'll just tell you that what it had to do was examine a very, very large number of special cases. So it looks at a special case and it says, is this an instance? No. Is this an instance? No. Is this an instance? No. And then finally concluded that no such thing exists. Okay? So it was known that if such a thing did exist, it would have to be one of these several billion cases, and each one was examined by the supercomputer and said, no, it's not this one. Okay? But the trouble is, as I say, that it's probably made, you know, half a dozen mistakes. So along with the computer proof comes this very remarkable probabilistic argument, and it goes like this. The author, The mathematician said, look, what's the probability that the computer actually made a mistake that when it was examining a positive case and turned it into a negative case and figured that the probability of that is 1 in, and then gave some number like 10 billion or something like that. And so at the end, he said, okay, here's my theorem, and here is the probability that the theorem is right. Okay? I admit there is a chance that it's not right, but blah, 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 blah. Okay. Those are sort of part of the problem. All right? Now, the final thing is that, and especially for those of you who are teachers of math, you know that people can make mistakes in math, and one of the nicest ways of showing that someone's made a mistake in a computation is to draw a little picture and show that it can't hold, or show it, or give a counterexample by means of a picture. In other words, verbal symbolic reasoning can often go astray, and the way we correct it is with a picture. Okay, they're a wonderful aid that way. I got interested in visual reasoning inside mathematics because I was interested in thought experiments in physics. And what the exact connection is between the two, I don't know. But I'm always interested in it. And whenever I talk about one, I like to talk about the other. So this is just a little kind of aside, but I want to show you my favorite thought experiment from physics. And you can sort of think of that. There's an important methodological principle at issue here, because in the sciences, the orthodox view is the only way to acquire knowledge is through experience, actual sensory experience. It's the one and only source of knowledge. And that's sort of parallel to the mathematics case where we say the one and only source of knowledge in mathematics is proof, an actual proof of a theorem. And until we have a proof, we don't have knowledge. All right? So the two are, in a loose sense, related. And pictures in math sort of break the common view, or are opposed to the common view. And some thought experiments in physics are similarly opposed to this very common view inside the natural sciences. So look at this thought experiment. It's a wonderful thought experiment. It's my favorite. And it comes from Galileo, who's refuting Aristotle. And, one story, of course, has that Galileo is the father of modern science because, unlike those silly medievals who used to sit in armchairs and think about how many angels danced on the head of a pin, good old Galileo got out there and climbed up to the top of the Leaning Tower of Pisa, and he dropped musket balls and cannonballs to see which would hit the ground sooner. Well, Galileo himself said, oh, rubbish, I don't have to perform experiments like that. I can just figure it out in my head what's going on, and I can tell you the answer, and I don't actually have to perform the experiment. And his reasoning goes like this. Watch. Here's what Aristotle says, and common sense too, by the way. Heavy objects, like the heavy cannonball, will fall faster than the light musket ball. Well, if that's the case, then if I were to attach the musket ball to the cannonball, I'd have an even heavier object than the cannonball all by itself. So this composite object would have to fall faster than the cannonball alone. So far, so good. Ah, but look at this. This composite object is actually is got a heavy part, the cannonball, which wants to fall very fast, but it's also got this little light part, the musket ball, and it's going to act like a little drag. It's going to slow down the heavy cannonball. It's like a little parachute. Okay? So really, the heavy cannonball will actually fall faster than the composite object. Well, now you've got an absurdity. You've got the heavy object falling slower and faster than the composite object. That's just absurd. Okay? But there's an easy way to resolve this problem. You just make everything fall at the same speed. Then you don't get into a difficulty. And that's a stunning result. Okay? You all learned that in high school. You learned that all objects, you know, fall at the same rate. And it all comes from Galileo. But he didn't climb up the Leaning Tower of Pisa and drop things. Okay? What he did was think it through. Now, how they're related, how thought experiments in physics are related to picture proofs in math, I'm not quite sure. But I think it's sort of related stuff, and I like to think about them together. Now, here's a really interesting question. How come pictures work? Okay? They don't work all the time, of course, but they work some of the time. Why do they work? When they do work, why do they work? What is it about them that makes them work? Okay? Now, there's a well-known logician, John Barwise, who sadly died just a few years ago. But he was one of the few people who were keen on pictures and pictorial arguments inside math and logic. He held the following view as an explanation for what's going on when a picture proof works. He said that a picture is isomorphic, or at least homomorphic, to its object. That's a very sensible thing to say. By the way, isomorphic means has the same structure. Okay? It's a technical term and has a technical definition, but it's a very easy concept to understand. It just means has the same structure. Now, why does a picture work? Well, it's dead easy in the case of ordinary pictures. So if I didn't know Howard, but I had a color photograph of him, I could learn a lot about Howard just by looking at the photo. I could say, well, he seems to have the standard number of ears. And sure enough, the real Howard actually has two ears as well. And you can sort of read things from the picture into the object that it's a picture of because of this similarity of structure. Now, one thing about isomorphisms is this. For two things to be isomorphic, they've got to have the same number of components. So my two hands are isomorphic because I can pair them up. Okay, I can just put them like this. They've got the same number of members. But if my right hand had 10 fingers and this one had 7 fingers, then there'd be no isomorphism between my two hands. Okay, you must have the same number of entities. So isomorphism is out when you consider pictures like this, for the simple reason that there are finitely many objects here, but infinitely many numbers. That's what the theorem's about. And somehow or other, the picture seemed to tell us about all infinitely many numbers. Okay? All right, well, what about homomorphism? See, this is a much weaker notion. It's a little harder to explain. Let me just say it's a weaker notion of isomorphism. All right? The trouble with homomorphism as an explanation of why I can look at this and get the theorem, okay? The trouble is there are just too many homomorphisms between the picture and the actual infinitely many natural numbers. Okay? There are all kinds of structures. And somehow or other, I'm able to look at the picture and figure out the right one. Okay? So something else is going on. It can't be the fact that there is a homomorphism, which there certainly is, but that can't be what's doing it for me. So it's a nice idea, and I think it works in a lot of cases. An awful lot of pictures work because of the isomorphism or perhaps a homomorphism. But it can't be working in this case. Here's another hypothesis about what's going on in the picture. And it goes like this. Remember I said that the standard proof for this theorem is a proof by mathematical induction. And that's the sort of thing that your ordinary working mathematician would like. Okay? But it's not going to work here. Well, I don't think it's going to work here. But some people looking at this example say, well, I think what it does is it suggests a kind of proof, so-called proof by mathematical induction, okay? And that's what's really going on. So the picture isn't really doing the work. All it is suggestive of the real proof, And it's the real proof that that is actually what's doing the work and establishing that that theorem. I'm not really sure how to rebut that. All I can say is that in my own case, I don't see it there. I don't see so-called mathematical induction in the picture. The key idea when it comes to mathematical induction is this: you pass from it holds for this number, therefore it holds for the next number. Okay? And I don't think you see that in the picture at all. You just see it holding. You see it holding in that particular case. You don't look at the picture and say, aha, it holds for 3, therefore it holds for 4. Well, maybe you do. But you certainly don't see that if it holds for arbitrary number n, therefore it holds for arbitrary number n plus 1. I'm just not convinced that that's the case. Though I admit I've got no really good argument to defeat that view. Sometimes when I try that example out on mathematicians, we take a little poll, and about half are like me. They don't see induction in it at all, and the other half do, and we just shout at each other, and that's all I can say. All right, now I want to tell you something that's a little goofy, probably, and this is the part that's outrageous, all right? Oh, before I show you that, let me prepare the ground. Here's my hero, Gödel. This is a very famous passage from Gödel, and he is a Platonist, and a Platonist believes two things. A Platonist in mathematics believes two things. First, a Platonist believes that mathematical objects have a life of their own. They're not made up by us. They're not in our heads. They don't just come out of our language or something like that. They're not to be found in the physical world. Okay? Numbers aren't apples. They're not part of our neural structure. They're completely independent from us, okay? And when we talk about mathematics, we're talking about, you know, some kind of objective existence. The second thing Platonists believe, especially if you're like Gödel, is that we actually have a kind of mental ability to see them, to grasp them. Here you can only talk metaphorically. You talk about something like the mind's eye. I can see numbers and sets and functions and so on. I see it with my mind's eye. It's a very unfortunate way to talk. But I think that's what we're reduced to. But the thing is that mathematical experience is of such a kind that it, for a great many people who work in math, they just feel overwhelmed by these intuitions that they have, and it seems like, you know, it's just coming from outside of them and just forcing it on ourselves, okay? It's not like the rules of a game or something like that where we could discuss it and talk about whether this rule of chess would be more fun or that rule of chess would be more fun. It just seems to just crush us, these intuitions, okay? So here's a quote from Gödel. Despite their remoteness from sense experience, we do have something like a perception also of the objects of set theory, as is seen from the fact that the axioms force themselves upon us as being true. I don't see any reason why we should have any less confidence in this kind of perception, i.e., in mathematical intuition, than in sense perception. That is, I'm quite convinced there's a physical world out there because I see you, I see things, and so on, and I have mathematical perceptions that are like that, but they're perceptions of the mathematical realm. All right. These intuitions are not just common sense, and the best, the high quality intuitions often require real ingenuity, something that a picture, a very clever picture, might in fact help you with. Okay? Now, I want you to keep that in mind. And now I'm going to go to, having rejected the barwise isomorphism story, and having rejected the, oh, it's really just suggestive of induction story, here's what I want to say, and give you a girdle-type answer to what's going on in picture proofs. Okay? The picture is actually not a picture. It's a different kind of thing entirely. It's actually an instrument for perception. It's like a telescope. For what? For looking into Plato's heaven, so that you can actually grasp the relevant mathematical rules. Okay. Now this would be largely dismissed by virtually everybody I know. But I think that one has to give an account of how pictures work. And it's a mystery how they work. I've given you a couple of answers which I think don't work, and then a third one which, you know, you may worry about for other reasons, but, well, it's got something going for it. And of course, as I say, I'm never troubled by appeals to authority. Okay. Now, okay, so far I've been singing the praises of pictures, but I want to actually insert a caution. A lot of people will say this, oh, pictures are wonderful for insight. Okay, they give you real insight into a mathematical structure. Not evidence, but they will give you insight, and pictures are to be praised for that reason. Certainly a great many mathematicians will say that. I actually think there's some reason for worry about that view. In fact, I think my little number theory example that I've been using here is should not be understood that way. Okay? So the common view is that pictures provide insight but not evidence. I actually want to reverse that in this particular case. Okay, I think in this example here, the theorem that went along with this, I think this is a real proof. This proves that theorem. It's evidence. And it's just as good as a traditional proof by induction. Here's what I want to say, though. When it comes to insight, I don't think that actually gives you all that much insight. I don't think you get much insight into how the natural numbers work from looking at that. On the other hand, a proof by so-called mathematical induction is fantastically filled with insight into how the natural numbers work. If you want to be friendly with the numbers, you understand induction. You're going from n to n plus 1. Okay, that's just so basic when it comes to numbers. And so that if you want insight into that theorem, if you want to understand how it works, it's the proof by induction which will actually give you more insight. However, don't discard the picture proof. It really is a proof. Okay? It really is evidence. I know there's some mathematicians in the audience, and I promised one or two of them that I would do something fairly absurd. And so, all right, get ready. all of the picture proofs that I've given you so far have been of theorems that can be proven independently of the picture proof. There's regular proofs of them. So you could say, oh, yeah, okay, they're fun, but frankly, anything we can do with a picture, we can do in a traditional way, so really they're redundant. They are fun, and maybe they're also real proofs, but strictly speaking, we can eliminate them, because we can always prove in a more traditional way with a verbal symbolic proof. Well, now I want to give you an example where that is just impossible. Okay? So picture proofs might earn their way in the world if you can actually prove something new, really new, okay, that can't be proved any other way. And that's what I want to try now. I'm going to try refuting the continuum hypothesis. Okay, there were some snickers for good reason. The continuum hypothesis is a conjecture from Cantor. It comes from the late 19th century. A little more than a century ago, David Hilbert made it problem number one in his famous lecture on mathematical problems. And it's been certainly one of the great unsolved problems since the time of Cantor. It's, I don't know, in the pantheon of unsolved problems, I don't know where it stands. I think if you ask most mathematicians, they'd probably say the Riemann hypothesis is number one. But the continuum hypothesis has got to be down there, at least in the top five, let's say. All right? Now, something remarkable happened in a number of years ago with the continuum hypothesis. It was proven independent of the rest of set theory. Okay? You can't prove it. And you can't refute it either. It's consistent with the rest of set theory, but its negation is also consistent with the rest of set theory. So there's going to be no proof. Okay? No ordinary proof at all. That's demonstrable. Okay, for those of you who don't know it, the continuum hypothesis is about the transfinite cardinal numbers. And very briefly, it goes like this. The cardinality of the set of natural numbers, how many natural numbers are there? That's called, there are infinitely many of them. It's called a countable infinity. It's the smallest infinite set. Okay? And its cardinal number is Aleph 0. And then the real numbers, okay, these are all the points on a line. In fact, just the points between 0 and 1, that'll do. That's an even bigger set, okay? There's a lot more of those than there are natural numbers. It's in this hierarchy of infinite numbers, it's higher. But how much higher? Cantor thought it was the next biggest number, okay? Now, we know that how big it is. We know that it's 2 to the Aleph naught. That's how many members, that's how many real numbers there are. So it's huge, okay? But it's possible that it's the next biggest infinite number, or it might be the 27th biggest infinite number, or it might be infinitely, you know, far down the hierarchy of infinite numbers. As I say, it's independent. We just don't know. Now, a word about the philosophy of mathematics. Lots of people say, look, mathematics is a kind of human creation. To say something is true is to say it's one of those accepted axioms or is a consequence of those axioms. So if the continuum hypothesis is independent of the rest of set theory, then it's neither true nor false. Okay? That's just a bad attitude. The right attitude is, well, it is true or false, but we can't determine which in the normal way. Okay, we'll have to find some other way. Here's my hero again. This is Gödel. He's claiming that a question not decidable now has meaning and may be decided in the future. New mathematical intuitions leading to a decision of such problems as Cantor's continuum hypothesis are perfectly possible. Okay? Now this is what I want to focus on. New mathematical intuitions leading to a decision. Okay? They are possible. Now, I'm going to give you a refutation of the continuum hypothesis. And remember, this can't be done in the normal way. Okay? So if I give you if pictures play a role, they're going to be playing an essential role because there's no regular proof that could correspond to them. Freeling, I think, refuted the continuum hypothesis in 1986, and everybody ignored it. Of course, that's always dangerous. Maybe they've ignored it for a very good reason. I mean, maybe it's just bad. I don't know. This is one of those cases where I'm inclined to think Freeling is right, but I don't feel all that confident about it, okay? So what I'm going to do is just present it to you and hope that you enjoy it, okay? One of the reasons it might have been ignored is not because it's a bad argument, but because of the actual way that he goes about it. It's of course, completely unusual inside math to argue this way. Okay, now there are some technicalities here, all right? This is more technical than the other stuff, but I'll sort of try to explain and wave my hands a little bit as we go along, all right? Some things, parts of it you'll just have to accept on faith, all right? Mostly I'm giving this example to really irritate a couple of friends here who are mathematicians. I know they'll be deeply annoyed. All right. What we're going to do is assume the what's called Zermelo-Frankel set theory, including the axiom of choice, just abbreviated ZFC. And we're also going to assume that the continuum hypothesis is true. We're going to get a reductio ad absurdum out of this. All right? Now, the points of the line, just say the points between 0 and 1, can be what are called well-ordered. This is an unusual notion. What it means is that if you take a set and order it, any subset that you take out will always have a first element. Right? That's the technical definition. Okay? It's a really important concept and has applications all over mathematics. So what we're going to, but it follows from the axiom of choice, it follows that every set can be well-ordered. Okay? So the set of points, P, in the interval 0, 1, can be well-ordered. And this, by the way, this little inequality sign here, that's the well-ordering. Now, nobody has the foggiest idea what a well-ordering of the real numbers would look like. It's never been exhibited. What we know is that it exists, we just don't know what it looks like. I mean, if you were to find it, if you go home tonight and work on it and find it, I promise you, mathematical fame and fortune. But it's hard as hell, okay? You probably won't get it, all right? But we know that it exists. All right. Now, we'll take, if we just took, you mustn't think of the well-ordering as like the ordinary ordering. I mean, half might be earlier than, in a well-ordering, it might be earlier than one quarter and so on. It's just, it'll just be a wild jumble of numbers. Okay? All right. Now, the points, as I was saying, the points can be well-ordered so that for each number q, this set, the set of well-ordered points, okay, which are less than Q, is what's called, is a countable set. That is, it's an infinite set, but it's not the same size as the set of real numbers. It's smaller. It might be infinite, but it's down to the size of the natural numbers. That's a big jump down. Okay? Why does that happen? There are technical reasons for this having to do with the way cardinal numbers are defined. They're defined as the smallest ordinal, and it follows for that reason. But I can give you a very simple example to make this seem intuitive. Suppose you pick any number out of the natural numbers. The natural numbers, by the way, are well-ordered in their ordinary ordering. If you pick any number out of them, there's infinitely many numbers, but pick any one, you know, pick number n. How many numbers are earlier? Only a finite. How many numbers are later? An infinite, okay? Whenever you do something like that, the set of points that are earlier, the set of numbers that are earlier, that precede, is always going to be much smaller cardinality-wise, okay? So anyway, this set is now going to be countable. And we'll just call it SQ, okay? SQ is the set of those numbers that precede in the well ordering. All right? And that's just a statement of what I already said. Now, what I want you to do is to imagine two people, and now here comes the visual, picturesque, thought experimental part of it. I want you to imagine two people, like me and Howard. And over there is the real line. It's just you know, a little line between 0 and 1. We've each got a dart, and we're going to throw it at the real line. And we're each going to pick out a real number. Okay? And we'll throw on the count of 3. 1, 2, 3, go. We each throw. And our throws are independent of one another. That is, my throw isn't going to affect his. His isn't going to affect mine. Of course, if we have an accident and our darts collide or something, we'll just start over again. So we're each going to define a set of real numbers, okay, by the number we pick out. So I hit a number, P, and I'm going to define the set of points, real numbers, that precede the point P in the well ordering. And Howard's going to pick out a number Q, and it's going to define the set of all points earlier than Q in the well ordering. And each of our sets is countable. There are infinitely many numbers bigger than my point P. There's uncountably many bigger, but only countably many smaller. And Howard, exactly the same. Okay? Now, how does Howard argue? He says, ha! When I hit the point Q, I defined a set of points that are earlier in the well ordering than Q, and it's only a countable set. What are the chances Jim is going to land his dart in there? Well, it's zero. Zero probability. It's logically possible, but zero probability. And that's because of for a technical reason which the mathematicians will understand. It's a measure zero set. And so in probabilistic terms, it means that the probability of landing in that set is zero. I reason exactly the same way. I say, hey, my point Q defines the set of all points earlier in the well ordering than Q. And it's a countable set. So the chances of Howard landing in my set are zero. See, so we reason exactly the same way. And my reasoning is impeccable, and so is his. But the trouble is, one of us is going to land in the set defined by the other. Okay? Because this is a total ordering. One of us is going to land in the set defined by the other. Every time a pair of darts are thrown, something that shouldn't happen at all is going to happen. Namely, an event with zero probability is actually going to happen. Now notice, I have to, because a lot of you are thinking, oh, this is stupid, because when cars come by and I say, oh, look at that eight-digit number, what are the chances that that could have happened, you know? And it's not actually working like that, because you see, in our cases, we're defining the set before the other dart hits. The throws are independent of one another, and so it's much more like writing down a license number well in advance of the next card coming and getting it right. It's that kind of chance. Okay, it's very bizarre. Yet every time a pair of darts are thrown, we're going to have that sort of thing happen. Why did it happen? It happened because the initial well ordering has length Aleph 1. If it had length Aleph 2, I couldn't run this argument, because then the bump down would just take it to an Aleph 1 set, and then you couldn't use that zero probability argument anymore. So maybe the continuum is Aleph 2, or Aleph 3, or 4, or whatever, but it can't be Aleph 1. And because it can't be Aleph 1, the continuum hypothesis is false. Okay? Now, notice how the argument goes. The crucial thing is the dart throwing in it, that somehow or other it generates a concept of randomness and independence that is different than anything in standard mathematics. I mean, there are concepts of a random variable in ordinary mathematics. There's measure theory linked to probability theory in ordinary mathematics. Somehow or other, we're getting an argument that's independent of all of that. It's somehow different. Okay, and if the the picture, the pictorial argument, the visualization, the thought experiment, somehow or other is able to give us a conclusion that ordinary mathematics couldn't give us. And so now, going back to Gödel, I'd say this may, in fact, be one of those cases where we've managed, somehow or other, to generate a new kinds of mathematical intuitions that are actually settling an old question, namely the continuum hypothesis. So why don't I end on that note? Okay, thank you.
So we have time for some questions.
The picture proofs have a characteristic that there are two parts that are not members of themselves, yet refer to the same thing. So in a sense, you have something that somehow extends, and then there's another part that does not extend. It's linear as opposed to nonlinear. So that, in a sense, is a Russell set type construction. You have things that are not members of themselves.
Sorry, is there a particular, was there a particular example?
It could be any example. I'm just trying to think of a generic way of thinking of the nature of proof. You have two parts,
yeah,
but they're not members of themselves in the sense that there's something characteristically different, categorically different about each part. Like you have a picture opposed to a linear series, mathematical series. So these things are not members of themselves, and yet they refer to the same thing. So that's a Russell set type construction.
Yeah. I'm not sure that I see the connection to the Russell set, but I think I have a vague idea of what you're getting at about somehow or other the picture being different than the thing it's picturing. It's certainly true that, I don't know, like a proof by induction, you use numbers to prove a theorem about numbers. And when I use a picture proof, it seems like I'm using a kind of category of objects that are wildly different than what they're attempting to prove. And that's certainly an interesting point. And if that's sort of what you're getting at, I think it's interesting and important.
With the last the proof that you just did, it seemed like it was more like,
sorry,
rather than
wave,
a picture.
I can't see you. Ah, okay, good.
It seemed like it was more like a, like talking about throwing darts is like a physics, like you're talking about physical things instead of mathematical things. And I guess it's the idea of being able to generate a random number that's really random. Has anyone tried to make that like some sort of mathematical equivalent of throwing darts at a line?
As far as I know, there's no way of generating random numbers. Except maybe if you think that something like quantum mechanics is inherently statistical, and then you use decay processes to somehow generate numbers. Computers often generate random numbers, but they're following a kind of algorithm, and they're not really, they're what's called pseudo-random numbers. The thought experiment, I think, is probably essential to this, because even if you used a computer to generate real numbers, you're not going to generate real numbers with infinitely many, you know, with infinite extensions. You're actually just going to have, you know, some 5 or 10 or 20 decimal places, something like that. I think this is probably essentially a thought experiment. And of course, realistically, there's no way Howard and I can pick out individual real numbers on a line, which is infinitely thin. You know, we can't pick out infinitesimal points with our fat little darts that are going in there. It's completely idealized.
I guess the question was, has anyone tried to prove with math or logic that there is a process that will generate random numbers that are, so to try and just say, here's how you can visualize it, there actually is a way that you can do this, it's just that you need an infinite amount of time or something.
Oh.
Just to make it a solid proof.
If you help yourself to an infinite amount of time, you can do a lot. Most processes you imagine, you know, you can only carry out so many steps or something like that. So you've exited from the realm of the practical by giving yourself an infinite amount of time, and you've entered my little world of thought experiments and idealizations and stuff like that. You'll enjoy it. It's more fun there, but it's not going to be very practical. And as for whether there's in principle, is there some way of generating random numbers? I don't know. You have to talk to computer scientists. I suspect it's just impossible. I mean, that's a kind of vague intuition, I actually don't know.
Thanks.
Probably not.
You cited the example of Lagrange.
Yes.
Who really denigrated figures, but didn't Isaac Newton do the exact opposite? Like, didn't he figure out elliptical orbits by calculus, but then when he published it, he reworked all the proofs in terms of classical geometry and, in fact, included figures in the Principia. So, you know, not everybody denigrates figures.
That's a good point. I'm not an historian. There is actually a Newton historian here, and so he could actually probably answer your question much better than me. I gather that it's true that Newton solved a lot of his problems with calculus and then geometrized them, actually sort of into a language that he thought other people could perhaps better understand. I don't know about the attitude, because, I mean, in a certain sense, he's doing geometry. All right? And geometry has always been comfortable with pictures. It's when you do analysis and number theory and so on, there that people think that, there they take the attitude like Lagrange and say that, well, you know, they're nice, they're suggestive, they're pedagogically helpful and so on, but you must not consider them as part of the evidence. So.
Dr. Brown, my question is, looking at some of those diagrams, they do seem very convincing as proof, to the extent that if you came up with a mathematical proof that didn't agree with those pictures, I'd trust the picture first. What enables you to tell whether to trust the picture or the mathematical proof?
That's a really good question. I don't know. I think that's the sort of thing that I would encourage you to look into. and anyone else here whose appetite is in the least whetted by these sorts of examples. It seems to me that there's just a hell of a lot of stuff to discover here. You know, what properties of pictures, you know, work particularly well? When do we tend to make mistakes more often with the use of pictures? I mean, it's just an awful lot of stuff that I think is just remains to be learned. Yeah. And like you, I don't know what I do. Like, suppose, like my little number theory example, where my little staircase type proof, I find it utterly convincing. Suppose that I'd never seen a proof by induction, and someone, Howard, comes along and says, well, actually, this isn't a theorem, it's false. And he gives me a counterexample, or he gives me a proof by induction of something that's contrary to this, okay? I'd actually be stumped. I don't know what I'd do. But I think mathematics, and this is a slightly deviant view, I think mathematics is fallible. For me, it's not the home of absolute certainty, as it is for a great many people. And I think that it's like in physics. I could have a terrific theory that's explaining a whole lot, and along comes a counterexample, and I just don't know exactly what to do, at least initially. I might say, well, look, this observation you made in the lab, I mean, maybe you were drunk, or maybe your instruments are dirty, or, you know, I struggle and squirm a lot, and I might eventually give in and go back to the drawing board, but it would probably be a long process.
Hi. There are visual notations that have formal semantics, for example, Petri nets.
And there are visual notations that have formal semantics, for example, Petri nets. There, you could also stretch a point and consider the funny symbols that we often use in formal mathematical proofs to be a kind of a visual notation because they have, you know they don't look like a logic, and we define our own little symbols all over the place.
Some people actually do that.
Right.
Yeah.
But when you're talking about visualisms, I suppose you are talking about not well-defined visualisms, or
yeah. You're absolutely right. I think there's probably a big fuzzy area. I would be loath to offer some kind of definition in advance of what I mean by a diagram. Say a diagram is, and then give necessary and sufficient conditions. I'd rather leave it vague. I'm pretty sure I know what a diagram is in almost every case, and I'll let the fuzzy boundary cases sort of let them sit at the side, and maybe 50 years from now, when we've figured out a hell of a lot more about how diagrams work, then I'll be able to either include them or not in a more precise account.
So what you're arguing for is the use of things that give you intuition, which might be informal diagrams, but might also be informal arguments. I mean, that seems to be the real argument here, rather than visual or not visual.
Sorry, I don't think I caught the last part. Could you repeat the last thing?
Well, you seem to be arguing visual versus not visual.
Yeah.
And it seems to me that it's formally defined versus not formally defined. That formally defined visual things aren't the thing you're talking about. You are talking about things that don't have formal semantics that give you insight into something. That seems to be the bigger
argument. Yeah, that's an interesting observation. But no, I don't think that is quite how I see it. I'm arguing for pictures as being evidence. When it comes to verbal symbolic proofs, some of them are highly formalized, and others are very informal. It's a kind of colloquial English, a few symbols, sketchy, and that I take to be also a non-visual argument. Okay, so I don't think it's sort of formal, non-formal. That's not quite going to be right, I don't think.
I'd like to say that I think I agree with your idea that thought experiments in physics and picture proofs in mathematics are somehow connected. My intuition tells me that. And I'm wondering if in physics we have a split of believers and non-believers in thought experiments the way we do in mathematics with picture proofs.
Uh-huh. No. Curiously, no. Mathematicians, it's not universal, but for a great many mathematicians, it's a major point of ideology that pictures aren't allowed. They, you know, scold their students and so on. There's a nice passage from Einstein. Einstein says he considers himself an unscrupulous opportunist when he's doing science. And what he means is that any particular methodological rule that there is out there, he's willing to violate it in order to, you know, if he thinks he's going to be successful doing his physics. And I suspect attitudes like that are probably more common in physics. So they're very happy to use thought experiments and, use a calculation here, an observation there, a thought experiment over there. It's all fine. Okay, they'll fight it out. They'll fight it out one at a time. Now, I see some are making faces, so maybe somebody objects. But I'm more inclined to think that there's probably less ideology about what evidence is in physics than there is in math. Right? Does that seem right to you?
I'd like to go back to your remark a few minutes ago that you find that picture, the two pictures of the step, you know, the painting.
Yeah.
Okay, that you find that really plausible. It's clearly wrong. And, you're kind of, I thought maybe perplexed isn't quite the way word, quite the right word. But, how do you rectify it? Doesn't that kind of raise an issue of context? I mean, simply, how do you position the picture? If you take the bottom picture and put it over top of the top picture, you'll see then that the incremental amount of paint that you have to add at every step is actually growing, and so it leads you then to the right conclusions. The issue is really
it's just the wrong picture, or you put the pictures in the wrong position more than anything else. I just wonder how that context, that sort of thing matters.
Yeah, I think you're probably right. Almost every picture that I can think of offhand, it's just a solitary picture. I can think of examples which fit your claim nicely. I have a very nice book on topology, and it actually has the wonderful title, The Picture Book of Topology. And there's lots of definitions and theorems and proofs in the ordinary sense, but the book's full of pictures. And one of the really nice things it does is show you, it gives constructions in a step-by-step way. It shows you how to turn this bizarre topological creature inside out, okay? And it does it in a sequence of drawings. And here's where I think your claim is right. Like, if you change the sequence, you'd screw up everything. So this is like your point about context, I think. That if this picture here works really well in the context of that one before it and that one after it. In that sense, it's just like words. This string of words is brilliant. Change the nouns and verbs around and it just becomes junk. So I'm sure pictures can be like that. They're found in a context, and in some wonderful cases, there'll be sequences of pictures to do something wonderful. Knot theory. Knot theory is full of that. By the way, knot theory is a wonderful subject if you're interested in these kinds of things, because knot theory doesn't have a single dominant notation. Everybody has his or her own special notation for knot theory. And different notations are absolutely brilliant in the problems they'll solve. So there's a Conway notation that'll solve all kinds of problems spectacularly, but won't solve others. And then there's these bracket notations and so on, which will solve different kinds of problems and leave others unsolved. Nobody has a single one that works everywhere, and almost everybody has drawings, actual drawings, as part of the notation.
Hi. The one thing I noticed was with your examples, there's a lot of squares in your examples. I was just wondering maybe
squares, yeah.
If there were some like circle proofs or triangle proofs or trapezoidal proofs, because those would be really cool looking. And I like the squares, but I just wonder if there's other ones out there.
Modest beginnings. I'm branching out to pentagons next week.
Oh. Jim, years and years ago, when you started the subject, I should begin this way. I lost the $10 bet because I said Brown is going to talk about Bolzano's intermediate values theorem.
And I thought I wouldn't have enough time.
And you didn't. When you started this in Dubrovnik years and years ago,
yeah.
You actually claimed that the graphic proof was better than Bolzano's proof, which is...
Was what?
Than Bolzano's proof of the intermediate value theory. The graphic. Yeah.
How long ago did I claim that?
Sorry?
How long ago? Did you say 10 years ago?
10, 12 years ago, something like that, when you started this.
Might be.
You've given this up, I hope.
Yeah, but I have a more modest but truer claim.
About that theorem or generally?
Yeah.
Well, okay.
Well, let me tell you what it is. This will be for the mathematicians in the audience, because it'll take too long to explain it. The intermediate value theorem says that if you've got a continuous function and it goes from negative values to positive values, somewhere along it's got to have an intermediate value. If it crosses the axis, it's got a zero value.
Zero, yes.
Yeah. Okay. So now Bolzano proved this in 1820, roughly. And it's considered one of the landmarks in the history of analysis. And almost any time you encounter the theorem in a textbook on calculus or analysis, there'll be a diagram with it, just a little picture. And you look at the diagram and you say, oh, of course, it has to be true. It's obvious. Now, if I ever claim that it's a proof of the theorem, that was probably an overstatement, because the theorem is of incredible generality. Here's my more modest claim. What Bolzano was doing was initiating a program that we now call the arithmetization of analysis. He's actually the father of this program. And his proof is the first instance of a certain way of proceeding. And it became the model for analysis in the 19th century and to this very day. My claim is this. How do you know the arithmetization of analysis is a good way to proceed? It's revolutionary. How do you know this is the right thing? Answer. It has this consequence that it makes true something that is obviously true from the picture. Okay? Now here's wait, this is crucially important. You have to get this. It's like a conjecture. The arithmetization of analysis is not known to be true from the statement of it and proofs in it. You think, what on earth is this guy Bolzano doing? Why the hell doesn't he get back in his monastery? Okay? So how do you know it's true? Well, it's like somebody coming along and conjecturing quantum mechanics and saying, you know, look at all these calculations. Why don't you believe me? Well, I'll believe you if you can predict line spectra for various atoms. That's what's going to convince me. So the line spectra are the consequences of the theory, and I believe the theory because he's got the line spectra right. Okay? Now, why do I believe Bolzano? I believe Bolzano because he got the diagram right. Not that the diagram proves the theorem, but rather the theorem implies the diagram, and therefore it has a true consequence. Okay? And you see, it's a kind of evidence for he's on the right path. Now, how would you know he's on the right path? I say there's no evidence for the arithmetization of analysis except a few pictures that are consequences of the theory like that, so that the picture is essential to Bolzano. Okay, is that more plausible? Or is that so convoluted you don't believe a word of it?
So with that perspectival shift, I'd like to thank Professor Brown for a very stimulating interview. Thank you.